Book 5. Where have I read this before? Hint, the Odyssey. Meanwhile, Aeneas was leaning against the prow of his ship, watching the fire in Carthage shrink into the distance, and wondering what all the fuss was about. Though, knowing their track record, it probably wasn't a party. Aeneas, mate. Palinurus, Aeneas's captain, who keeps getting sporadic attention, called down to him. The winds are shite. I tried praying to Neptune, but it's doing nothing. Let's give up and go with fortune, shall we? I don't think we're too far from anywhere. Maybe. Whatever. Let's go back to Sicily, Aeneas shrugged. My dad's grave probs needs some fresh flowers by now anyway. Acestes, a Trojan, was king for this land. When he saw his friends arriving, he was pretty chuffed, which is a better reception than what they've had so far. The next morning, Aeneas called his men together over breakfast. All right, lads. It's been about a year since my dad passed. Jupiter rest his soul. So we ought to celebrate. You know, good old Trojan style. For piety's sake, you know, I'd do this anywhere, even if I was stuck in a Greek camp or in exile, but luckily I'm not. I'm here with you bastards instead. Could be worse. Let's have a laugh. We deserve some good food. We'll chuck a prayer in for the Penates for good measure. And in 9 days, we'll have some games. How about a boat race, a running race, wrestling, a bit of archery, maybe some horse racing? Bit like a sports day, but, you know, without the egg and spoon. What'd you say? Aeneas and all his men, and Ascanius even, put a garland of Venus's myrtle on their heads for no apparent reason, and went to perform the rites at Anchises' tomb. Once Aeneas had offered a libation, a snake appeared from beneath the shrine, slithering around the tomb, moving in 7 great coils and 7 great curves, the colour of a rainbow cast against the clouds in the sky. The snake had a nibble of everything on offer aside from the people, and went right away, leaving Aeneas, understandably, gobsmacked. He decided to kill a couple more bulls and do the rites again, just in case, and his mates followed suit. On the 9th day, a great crowd filled the shore, fueled by rumour and Acestes' good name, all desperate to catch a glimpse of Aeneas and his men. Prizes of sacred tripods, palm leaf crowns, talents of silver and gold, and purple dyed cloves were displayed, just to wind everyone up. A trumpet blew, and the games began. First, we have the boat race. To put it simply, there were 4 blokes, Menestheus, Gaius, Segestus, and Cloanthus, all trying to reach a rock in the middle of the ocean and, you know, come back again, obviously. They drew lots for their positions and were all very hot and nervous and excited, and they moved forward against the tide a bit like charioteers. Gaius was first and then Cloanthus, but Menestheus and Segestus were fighting for 3rd place. Gaius was bit of a competitive guy, and he kept yelling at his helmsman, Menotes, to go left, but he didn't. So when Cloanthus inevitably took over them, Gaius chucked Menotes into the sea, which is one way to get a job done. Apparently, the Trojans found this all very funny. Segestus and Menestheus were neck and neck, but Menestheus gave a very rousing speech, and Segestus got a bit excited and crashed into the rock, which, you know, wouldn't help. Menestheus overtook Gaius, but got a little bit confident, and Cloanthus remembered to pray to the sea gods because this is a very pious book, you see. Which meant he won. The moral of the story is you can do anything you put your mind to with the help of a few nymphs. So, Cloanthus won, but because Aeneas is pious and just and such a good sport, everyone got wine, 3 bulls of their choice, I mean, does it get any better, and some silver. Cloanthus got a lovely gold and purple cloak embroidered with a prince chasing stags and then being carried off by Jupiter's eagle, which is quite a lot to fit in a bit of fabric, really. My cross stitch is, you know, horrible. I wouldn't manage it. He got a crown too, of course, though, made out of leaves. Remember, no kings in this new republic. Menestheus got a fancy breastplate that his attendants found far too heavy to carry, even though one man had originally worn it. You get the picture. Oh, and third prize was basically a drinking cauldron. So, a small cauldron and a silver cup. Great. Segestus was a bit pissed off because he'd managed to save the ship that had been coiled like a mangled, half-dead snake around that rock. Lovely analogy, Virgil. But Aeneas had to look fair and so gave him a cretin slave woman with two sons. A bit like a Waitrose Essentials family starter pack. Then we've got the running race. There's a lot of names here, like the catalogue of ships all over again, so I'll run them off for you. So we've got Nisus, Euryalus, Diores, Salius and Patron, and Helimus and Panopes. But really, the only ones you need to remember are Nisus and Euryalus. Before they ran, Aeneas announced they'd all get a prize just for taking part. That's my kind of exercise, this. And they would get two cretin arrows and a two-headed axe. The winner would also get a horse. The second would get a quiver complete with arrows, otherwise, you know, it would be totally useless. And the third would get a great helmet. Lush. So Nisus was in the lead, then Salius, then Euryalus, and then we don't really care. Nisus slipped on some blood from the bulls, which really doesn't sound like a good omen, does it? But here's something. Nisus and Euryalus were young, I'd say maybe in their late teens, early 20s, and we're pretty sure they were in love. You've got to remember that. So, naturally, Nisus stuck out his leg and made sure Salius would trip too, so Euryalus would be in the lead. Euryalus won, Salius had a tantrum, and godlike Aeneas laughed and rumpled his hair and gave him the hide of a lion, reminding him they'd all get their prizes anyway. Nisus kicked up a fuss too then, so Aeneas gave him a shield that had once been dedicated by the Greeks to Neptune. So moral number two, if nymphs aren't on hand to help, try having a tantrum instead. Then we've got the wrestling. Is this getting a bit tedious yet? The winner would get a bull adorned with gold and ribbons, and the loser would get a sword and a helmet that, you know, they probably could have done with at the beginning in the first place. Dares, the only man to stand against Paris, which isn't really saying much, stood up, and he was so massive and cocky that he strode over to Aeneas and said he might as well forgo the fight and claim his prize now. On the sidelines, Acestes looked at Entellus. Mate, why don't you ever go? You could take that crown easily. The god Eryx was your teacher, wasn't he?
I'm not scared of a twat, Entellus sighed. I'm just old. I'm not interested in prizes, but he could do to be taken down a peg or two, I guess, couldn't he?
He then threw some enormous gauntlets made out of seven oxen that Eryx himself had used to fight in front of Dares. Aeneas picked them up and fidgeted with them, of course.
Eryx wore these when he used to battle Hercules. The sight of them seems to intimidate you, Dares. Not to worry.
Let's make it even. You lose your Trojan gauntlets, and I'll lose these. And then basically, me stripped off, which can't have been a pretty sight for especially for an old man, you know? Oof. So, Aeneas gave them both equal gauntlets. Very kind. Very equal. One old, frail man, one obnoxious youth. Sounds great, doesn't it? But we all know where this is going to go, don't we, really? Respect your elders and that kind of thing. They dealt blow upon blow, and Entellus was heavier and stayed firm, but his knees were quaking and his breath was haggard and uneven. But for Dares, it was like fighting a city or a mountain kingdom. No matter how hard he tried, he came to no avail. Until Entellus sent out the smacking one, but Dares ducked, and Entellus ended up falling flat on his face on the floor, like a hollow pine tree when it's felled. Acestes pulled him up, and Entellus was so humiliated that he bludgeoned Dares so much Aeneas had to intervene before he killed him.
Better give it up, mate.
He patted Dares on the back and handed him the helmet that would have probably stopped his head from spinning.
You see this bull? You see it? Entellus called. You see it, Dares? This is what I'd do to you, if no one had stopped me.
He then smashed the bull's head in. Lovely.
I think I'll retire now, he added.
Then we've got the archery. Aeneas used the mast from a ship and tied a dove to it as a target, which really sounds quite cruel, but there we go. And everyone drew lots to hit the dove. To summarise, Hippocoon, the youngest, hit the mast, but not the dove. Menestheus, again, missed the dove, his arrow accidentally freeing her, which sounds all right until Eurytion called out to his brother in prayer, so naturally he hit the dove mid-flight. Acestes decided he might as well try and show off his skill, even though there was nothing left to hit. And as his arrow flew into the air, it burst into flames and shot out like a shooting star. Unsurprisingly, everyone was a bit shocked. Here you go. Aeneas handed Acestes an old mixing bowl from his father. The gods obviously like you. Aeneas then had Ascanius called for, as he was going to lead the horses in honour of his grandfather. He's grown up very quickly in this book, Ascanius. Anyway, the boys all rode out looking very grown up and dashing for their proud parents. There was Priam, grandson of the Priam that we all know. Ates, a good friend of Iulus who had actually found the Atti of Latium. And then Iulus himself, of course, on a horse Dido gave him. Sore point, still. Eventually, they performed a mock battle along with some other kids too and unimportant to name, weaving paths in amongst one another like dolphins in the sea, like the impossible maze of a labyrinth. Ascanius would bring this tradition to Alba Longa, which would trickle down to Rome and is Virgil's explanation of why they called it the Trojan Games. By now, like many of the readers, Juno was bored. Nothing exciting was happening. These Trojans were having far too much fun. So she gave Iris a good poke and she went to visit the weeping women of Troy, all huddled and miserable on the shore, looking out at the wide expanse of sea and wondering how men could possibly enjoy themselves at a time like this, when they still had so far to go. This was great for Iris, of course. She took on the guise of Bero, an old, respected wife, and started to stir up trouble.
Oh, if only the Greeks had killed us. 7 years we've been travelling. 7 years! It's impossible. Who cares about Italy? We are in the land of friends, of Eryx and Acestes. What's the problem with staying here? It's nice enough. Let's burn these bloody ships. No one can make us travel then. Oh, and I had a dream where Cassandra basically handed me a torch and told me to do it. And we all know we should have listened to her.
To make a point, Iris snatched up a burning log and chucked it at the ships. The women stared at her. There was probably an awkward pause.
That ain't Barrow.
Pyrgo, the royal nurse, folded her arms.
She's too pretty and emotional. Barrow's like a corpse at the best of times. I just left her back there in a right state because she felt too ill to come to Anchises' ceremony.
The women stared at Pyrgo. Then Iris rolled her eyes and flew off as a rainbow, which was all the sign they needed to go totally berserk and begin to hurl flaming logs and branches at the ships. Think prequel to the Bacchae. Eumaeus brought the news to the Trojans, who once again had seen smoke and evidently not thought a lot about it. And Ascanius galloped to the woman. Again, he was sitting on Dido's lap in the last book. Just bear that in mind. Oh, my Jove, what are you all doing? You bloody mental, those are our ships, not the Greeks. Look, it's only me. At that point, he flung off his helmet, made to imitate battle, and Aeneas arrived. The women were stunned and fled into the woods and all across the shore. Juno had stopped possessing them, and they were a bit embarrassed now, as you might be. The ships were still burning, though, and fire was crackling and cackling away. So, of course, Pius, remember that one, Pius Aeneas threw out his arms. Jupiter, come off it. At least pretend you give a shit about us. Jupiter clicked his fingers, and a huge storm cloud billowed out of nowhere, and a torrent of rain put out the fires. They'd only lost 4, which isn't that bad. Aeneas, fairly so, was a bit stressed. He was starting to wonder what the point would be in going to Italy. They had already made home right there in Sicily. Why should he leave? The women were clearly feeling very upset, and he was tired of all this travelling. Why did he have to follow his fate? Why couldn't they just stay for once somewhere? Acestes had managed it. They could just carry on, continue the Trojan race there. Aeneas. It was Nautes. Athena had allowed him to have some understanding of the gods' ways, and he gave some comforting thoughts.
We need to leave, but Acestes, he's like you, he's a good leader. He's made a home here. Let the women, the old, the frail, anyone who is too tired for further travel, let them stay here with him. I think Acestes has a nice ring to it for a city, don't you?
As if Aeneas wasn't conflicted enough already, the ghost of Anchises appeared. As you do.
How you doing, son? Jupiter sent me. He's a decent guy, you know. He sent that rain cloud for your ships. Do as Nautes says. But come visit me in Hades, will you? Shouldn't be that difficult a trip, I imagine. The Sibyl will bring you. Not going to tell you where she is, though, or anything useful at all, but you'll be fine. Oh, and come to Elysium, not Tartarus. Don't get lost. Oh, that really muck things up. I'll get the kettle on, shall I?
Bloody hell, these sodding ghosts. Aeneas despaired as he watched his father go up in smoke, just as Creusa had in Troy. And he felt as helpless and alone now as he had then. Aeneas relayed the news to the others, and they were thrilled. Believe it or not, even though he probably did you think he mentioned the bit about going to Hades? Like, I don't think I'd be very pleased if my captain was like, oh, hey, do you want to go down to hell for a bit? It shouldn't be that bad. I don't know. Anyway, sorry. Acestes began to draw up the walls of his city, the temples, all the fortifications. After another 9 days of feasting, they like things in nines for some reason in this book, when the seas were calm, the Trojans parted. Another sacrifice was made, and Aeneas waved goodbye to half of his people, apparently without a care in the world really about it. Back on Olympus, Venus, emotional as always, went to Neptune.
Oh, I am sick of that horrid Juno being so nasty to my darling boy. She does not care for fate or her husband. She has destroyed the Trojans, and she is still relentless, and she's destroyed their home. You must know how I feel. Look how she took control of your kingdom with Aeolus. She's insatiable. She made half of the Trojans separate themselves from their friends. She's awful. Ghastly woman. Ghastly. Please, they're so close now to home. Let them reach Italy safely.
No worries.
Neptune patted her on the back. She was crying, but he didn't have any tissues. I don't think they really have Kleenex in Olympus.
I'll only take one of them as like a little sacrifice for myself, if you don't mind. I quite like Aeneas. I haven't got any problems with him. I'll get him home. It's fine. Just please stop crying. Please.
Neptune leapt into his chariot and made for the waves. Night had fallen. Everyone was resting. Palinurus, that helmsman, was at the front of the ship when the god of sleep whispered in his ear, "The seas are calm. 1 hour. Just a little nap. What harm could it do?"
"No," Palinurus stared out the sea. "Never trust the wind. Mm-mm-mm. Aeneas trusts me to get us home. I will not be falling asleep now. Mm-mm. You can't get me."
But the gods, as we know, can do anything they want. Sleep took out a branch dripping with forgetfulness and sleep, believe it or not, and shook it over Palinurus's head. Sure enough, he tumbled into the waves and right into the arms of Neptune. and the sea was appeased. They were nearing the Sirens once more. The seas were getting rougher, and Aeneas woke to find them adrift, without his helmsman. "Oh, you unburied idiot, Palinurus," he said gently, steering the ship onwards.